Okay, thank you very much to the organizers for the opportunity to speak. I would like to report on some progress in the study of defect CFTs of a special kind, interfaces between two theories. This is going to be a two-dimensional talk. Mostly, we can comment about higher dimension in the end if somebody is interested. And it's work in collaboration with Joao Penedones and the student Antonin Rousset in EPFL. So the outline is as follows. There will be a few words of motivation, a core part in which we discuss a measure of reflection and transmission for conformal interfaces. I'm going to explain all about it. Some comments and some consequences of the result. And then, depending on time and on preference of the audience, either one specific example or one still general application to non-equilibrium physics of the result. Okay, as I was saying, this talk is about defect CFTs. So here's the defect, and here are the CFTs. So this is the simplest possible setup you can imagine. It's two-dimensional conformal field theories. One, we pick two CFTs, which are in general different, but that can be glued at a conformal interface. I will give a definition of a conformal interface a bit more technical afterwards, but it's just some straight line which such that the physics of the theory preserves all the conformal transformations that do not move the line. So in particular, globally, one copy of SL2, locally, one copy of Virasoro in the two-dimensional case. Now, why are we interested, or why somebody's interested in defect CFTs? There's always the answer because they're there, but that's not usually the good answer, at least not for part of this audience. But they are there for good reasons. They measure the interaction between, they model the interaction between light degrees of freedom and heavy degrees of freedom. We're happy of having conformal field theories modeling what happens when we take our system to low energy, and we're left with some light matter propagating. But we may be interested in understanding how this light matter interacts with some heavy probe which is there in the system. It could be the boundary of the box, it could be a heavy particle electrically or magnetically charged. And so these are actually fundamental, they're not just, they don't just happen to be there, but they're also probes of the theory. And in particular, the result I'm going to discuss today, I hope will show that they can actually also teach us something about the CFT itself and not just about the defects that live in it. When we talk about defects, then there is a question of what is the goal. So one goal is the usual bootstrap goal, so solving the theory, and in particular finding all the CFT data, which are both the usual three-point functions and scaling dimensions, and the additional CFT data that live on the defect, that are associated to the defect. That's a goal which I don't address today, and it's still far away, except in a few situations in two dimensions, in particular when rationality comes to help. But there is another possible goal, which is to understand some feature of the system in a more qualitative way. In some sense, there are CFT data which are better than others or more equal than others. There are CFT data that could tell us something qualitative about the interface, even if we don't know every CFT data of the theory. And the question I would like to answer today is sort of the first question that comes to mind when we think about an interface between two theories, which is, how transparent is it? And the goal is to associate the transparency of the interface to a specific piece or a specific set of CFT data. So in order to do this, what we're going to think of is a scattering experiment. So we're sending some wave with some energy, and we'll measure how it comes out at infinity on one side and on the other. So vectorially, our transmission coefficient is going to be transmitted energy. Divided by incoming energy. And similarly for the reflection coefficient, is going to be the reflected energy divided by the incoming energy. Of course, the The rest of the work is in making precise what we exactly want to measure, what's the observable. I would like to mention that in the literature there was already a definition, well, something that was called the reflection transmission coefficients for conformal interfaces in a beautiful work by Quella, Runkel, and Watts in 2006. And it's routinely used to qualitatively characterize interfaces. It's computed, it's a piece of CFT data, it's associated to the boundary state. And OK, I wrote it here, one definition of it. So we're going to find something very similar to that reduces to this in some special cases. But we're going to make some progress. So this coefficient had the property that reflection plus transmission is equal to 1, which is good. I'm going to explain why it is good, actually, because you could ask, what about energy trapped on the interface? And has the property that it's 0 for topological interfaces, and it's 1, the transmission for topological interfaces, and it's 0 for boundary conditions. So this was prompting the authors to call this reflection and transmission coefficient, but there was really no deep physical intuition behind it, except it worked. It worked very well. In particular, you see, the notation here just means that there is a two-point function. The details are not very important, but there is a two-point function of the stress tensor, one on the left and one on the right, and the anti-holomorphic counterparts, and that's measured transmission. So, okay, it's measuring somehow how the theory on the left talks to the theory on the right. The problem with that is that you would not know what exactly is being transmitted and what exactly is being reflected. And it looks like an amplitude more than a coefficient. You would expect from something like this that the square of this should sum to 1. It's a two-point function. So, okay, so these questions we're gonna answer in the following. So to get started, the first, so this is enough for motivation. So let's go to the second point. R&T. So the first comment I would like to make to set up the stage is a simple comment about propagation of matter into the CFTs, which just follows very simply from property of the stress tensor in any state of a 2D CFT. It's a holomorphically factorized, better. It's a sum of a holomorphic and anti-holomorphic piece. And, well, okay, there is a minus 1 over 2 pi, which is a convention. So what does this mean for us? It means that if I create at some time a bump, so the state here is some local operator which acts as some with some shift in imaginary time so that the state is normalizable, and this is the expectation value of the energy operator. And it will look like that. Right? It's just some power law tail, and it acts at say t equals 0. But then this is just a piece, and in my notation, z is equal to x minus t, and z bar is going to be x plus t. So here I'm Lorentzian already. Okay, so what's going to happen is that it's going to split, right? It's going to have one bump and one other bump. They move away at the speed of light, and they're centered at x equal minus t and x equal t in the future. And in the past, it was the same, rigid, right? Rigid situation, just the opposite. They're coming towards each other. So the physics of this process is immediately the physics of some colliding bumps of energy which just don't talk to each other. They pass through each other rigidly. They don't exchange energy. They go away. So this is one more motivation to study interfaces actually as probes of the theory, because it's a bit hard. It's hard to make left and right movers scatter in a CFT. The way to turn left and right left into right movers is actually to add an interface that will do the job. So. In particular, let's see what happens with an interface. So with an interface, we should discuss how the stress. I shouldn't write there? OK. Then I'll go right here. Because it's not in the screen. Thank you. So there is only basically one equation I need from boundary CFT, even if there's more detailed knowledge of what the defect CFT is. What I need is this is called Cardick-Lewin condition, and it's valid I'm not putting arguments, but it's valid at the location of the interface, even if it's holomorphic functions can be just analytically continued. So this is the condition for the interface to be conformal, or one of the conditions, the main condition for this talk. And it just means that the momentum across the interface is conserved, which is intuitive, but it can just be proven rigorously that if you want the translational invariance and scale invariance for the interface, that's a condition. And it gives you as a gift a full copy of your Lazarus algebra. You actually just need scaling to prove this. Okay, so what does this mean in terms of this bumps, moving bumps? It's a bit more intuitive if we write it in the other way. What it means is that when there's incoming energy on the interface, so T left is going to be measuring because of this convention right movers and T bar left movers. So they come here and they just go away with some other distribution perhaps, but nothing gets trapped, nothing gets absorbed at the interface. So a conformal interface, since what's lacking on the right-hand side with respect to some massive interface is a stress tensor. So since it doesn't have a local stress tensor, it cannot absorb energy. And since it cannot absorb energy, it's just going to reflect it, to glue the incoming and the outgoing waves and reflect them away. So the picture we have now for propagation of a state in a defect CFT is the following. So we're going to create our state. I'm going to be slightly more precise about what I mean in the following, but you can imagine just some compact support wave function, and we act with a local operator with a slight shift in imaginary time so that the state is normalizable. And then we're going to want to measure the expectation value of the energy operator, so we're going to act also with the Brach, right? So shift in the other direction in imaginary time. And okay, there are two moving bumps that come out. Of course, this picture is going to get modified. This is clearly exactly computable, right? It's a three-point function, but in the presence of the interface, it gets cross-ratio, so it's modified at when these bumps get close to the interface, the shape is a bit modified. But qualitatively, this is a shape. So the two moving bumps are going to be to go like this and like that to infinity. And then at something happens at the interface, which is this, they're going to be glued in some way. And this also only happens locally. Of course, this is still propagating rigidly. What the interface does is not to change the dynamics. The interface changes the way the state looks at t equals zero. Right? When I act with the local operator on the vacuum, I'm doing a Euclidean thing. I'm changing the vacuum everywhere. So this depends on what the theory does everywhere. Depends on the entanglement in the vacuum, etc. But when I evolve, everything is determined locally. So this bump, the fact that this bump moves at the speed of light in one direction is not affected by the interface until the bump hits the interface. Then it's just going to split. And it goes to infinity. It's interesting also to look at the past. Here, this is a Heisenberg state, right? We acted with imaginary time, and then we probe with local operator at the different real times. So we can just look at the past of the state. And what you see is that there's something that came this way and something that came this way, the other two bumps in the past. And then something special must happen here, because on the other side, we had no bumps. So there is some very entangled pair of bumps that comes in and just cancels that so that the result goes to the left. You can verify this in three theories, but it's just the only possibilities. I'm loosely talking about these bumps. What I really mean are singularities in the three-point function that defines the state. And the position of the singularities in imaginary time is just going to be reflected in the position of these bumps. Okay, so the challenge is to, well, the task is to focus on this process. And ideally what we want to do is just to, so this is a collider experiment, it's just to going to measure the, let me write them somewhere. Well, it's just going to measure the integral of the stress tensor on the right. This I'm going to call epsilon. Here, to measure the energy that went through, and then on the other side, epsilon bar left, to measure the energy that went on this way. So the axes are z bar in the convention above, and divide by the energy that came in, so epsilon left Okay, so this is the idea. It's slightly, the reason why I went through this is because if we do just this, naively, this is not going to work clearly. It's not going to work because there's junk, right? We would like to isolate this process. The green one is the good one. But if we just integrate, we're going to get tangled with all of this other stuff. Right, in particular, epsilon left is going to measure also this energy here, and epsilon bar left is going to measure this energy that went away. So, but now that we understand the dynamics, it's going to be simple just to subtract these contributions away. So what is the problem, the specific problem? The specific problem is that if I create my state somewhere at finite distance from the interface, as I was saying, the state doesn't just look like the one without the interface. It's a complicated state. These things contain the correlation functions that define these things contain cross ratios. They're theory dependent, which just means that, okay, you can try. If you try with a free theory to see the profile of the energy when you create the state somewhere, it's going to be a bit crazy close to the interface. It could be negative. It could do many things. And in particular, it's going to be non-zero on the right already at time zero. So this is not good to isolate how much energy went through. So the way we solve the problem is to take a limit of this state that goes very, very far away. So this limit does two things. The first thing is that it makes this bump that comes in, the one we're interested in, exactly equal in the limit to the one without the interface. We're infinitely far away, so it just goes back to something that you can estimate without the interface in the translational invariant theory. And the other thing it does is that it also makes this bump that goes out there to be equal to the one without the interface. This is just the right mover, the left mover that was here in that picture. So we can just subtract, we can just estimate the energy, the incoming energy without the interface, and subtract off the reflected energy that we don't want, so the one that was not reflected, without the interface again. So in other words, this limit is putting under control the amount of energy that comes in and isolating this process. That is the one that we want to measure. And it will have some deep consequence because it will simplify very much the correlation functions that we're using. Okay, so I think I can then just go into the technicalities for 5 minutes and see how to prove the main result. If there are no questions. So this result can be proven in a completely generic way. I'm never going to use Virasoro, actually. I use holomorphicity is always a problem, but holomorphy of the stress tensor, but that's about it. So in the proof I'm going to present, I'm presenting now, is I'm going to choose states created by quasi-primary operators, but it's trivial to add derivatives and just to prove the same statements about any state in the theory. So the object we're dealing with is, sorry, before going into the proof, I should define, sorry. Yeah, exactly, it's better if I do this way, thank you. I'm going to define the observable and tell you the result, yeah. Because otherwise it's a bit too much for suspense. I wanted to do it before, then I forgot. So the transmission coefficient, let's just take the lesson that we proved here and that we got there and translate it. So okay, I should define the state that I want to measure. Actually, let me first tell you the result, because the result is just very intuitive. It doesn't depend on the technicalities, then we go into the technicalities. So the result is that this you can ignore for now. So the transmission coefficient is going to be a number that I parameterize this way, a ratio of two things. One, the denominator is just the central charge. The left here, the L here, means that I'm sending in matter from the left. There is clearly an equivalent process sending in matter from the right. And C left is the central charge to the left theory, the usual. C left right is the overlap of the stress tensor on the left with the stress tensor on the right. This is just slightly more general because if there are multiple stress tensors, which I'm going to comment on, the situation becomes a bit more general. Don't be puzzled, there are multiple stress tensors in 2D theories without the theory being factorized. But there's cosets, right? If you have an extended symmetry, you have all the quasi-primaries for the coset models. it's not really factorized, right? The theory is still interacting, but the grammar was good. Yeah, exactly. So the simplest example is the case in which I have one stress tensor, and then see left right is just the overlap between the stress tensor on the left and the stress tensor on the right. So this object is still one number, because although there is an interface, these are holomorphic operators, and therefore there are no cross ratios. So there is one number that measures this overlap. You can think of this as a piece of defect CFT data, actually, because the OPE of the stress tensor with the defect is non-singular, so you can think of it as a two-point function on defect, if you wish. So this is one number that fixes the transmission coefficient divided by the central charge. Now, why is this result non-trivial? It's non-trivial because I didn't tell you which operator I'm using to act on the vacuum. And the reason is that it doesn't matter. So you could expect, in principle, this process to depend on many things. First, the wave function I used to define my in-state, which is equivalent to, say, the momentum of the incoming particle. And second, the operator I use when I act on the vacuum to create the state. There are many operators in the theory. I could use any of them to create this bump of energy. And it's non-trivial that the transmitted energy, the average transmitted energy, does not depend on any of this. It only depends on one piece of CFT data, which is pretty much related to what Queller, Runkel, and Watts claimed it was the reflection transmission coefficient, with the exception that this is an average of left reflection and right reflection. So okay, so the non-trivial result is, or the non-trivial message, is that a conformal field theory in 2D at least, I think in higher D this will persist, but in 2D at least, conformal defects in 2D at least is pressed with a reflection and transmission coefficients which do not depend on the way we excite the vacuum. This is not telling us something only about the defects, it's telling us something about the theory. Because when I fix a unique interface in my theory and I start probing it with different local operators, well, what I'm seeing is a property of the conformal field theory. It just so happens that somehow the set of local operators excites the vacuum in a kind of uniform way. It excites it with a different distribution of momenta, which depends on the spin of the local operator, but when it hits the interface, the transmission of energy is the same. I do not know if this persists for higher momenta of the distribution. This is an interesting question for the future. So this is the result. Any questions on the result?
Sorry, can you say again, what is ELR?
Yeah, I can just rewrite it. Yeah, T left of Z, T right of Z prime, in the presence of the interface is this number divided by Z minus Z prime to the fourth. Okay. But you can think of it as a piece of the boundary state, if you prefer, if you follow the theory. But yeah. No, so it's true that this is a special case. There exists a topological interface, in particular the trivial interface if the theories are identical, but there exist non-trivial interfaces also if the theory are identical. So this is a property of the interface.
Yeah.
It is also the two-point function displacement operator. It is related to the two-point function displacement operator. This is something that I wanted to say in the comments, so maybe I'll hold on to that for a second.
Maybe it's better if we use the Q. Can I?
Should I think of this CLR as a coupling between the two CFTs?
It's one of the couplings, yeah. But again, so this is a defect CFT. The way we usually think about these things is that there is a set of CFT data which is associated to taking an operator in the bulk and bringing it to the defect, okay? When we do this, we have a defect OP which contains scaling dimension of defect operators and their bulk to defect couplings, okay? So this is just one of them. It's just one piece of CFT data. It's a bit better than the other pieces of CFT data for various reasons. One reason is that it measures the displacement operator, I'm gonna say it again later. Another reason is that it measures transmission and reflection. But it's just a piece of CFT data. There are quazillions of other pieces of CFT data in a CFT. It's not just decoupling. If you have a perturbative interface, of course, it's going to be proportional to the coupling. Other questions? Okay, if not, I'll just sketch out to prove the result. Okay, so. So yeah, so I would like now to define better the observables. So what I was saying is that I need to create my state and take a limit. So I define a one parameter family of states, which depend on some local operator that I'm going to take to be a quasi-primary for the talk. Yeah, let me skip the wave function part and just say I'm going to apply it at some reference point on the vacuum with the interface. So to be slightly more precise, Z is going to have a slightly positive imaginary part. This is not very relevant. I mean, it is relevant, but the idea is just that this creates a state. So these two points are there. Of course, it's completely conventional. It's there because I could convolve with a wave function to create a non-trivial state. So I'm just going to leave those labels there. But I didn't put them here because they're not so important. So it's a one-parameter family of states that depend on d. D is the distance from some reference point, say, back in this direction. I'm going to take d to infinity to bring the state, to make a state being created in the far past and disentangle the two processes that I said. So then my transmission coefficient for matter incoming from the left is just going to be the expectation value in this state of, well, let me just call it, since I'm going to write it a few times, epsilon r, which is the NEC operator. I'm going to write it in a second on the right. So let me just write it. Epsilon r is minus 1 over 2 pi integral of dz tr of z. And of course, all the other epsilons are similar. So these are the guys that I defined here. So I want epsilon r here to measure the state. And I want to divide by the incoming state. Now, the difference is that when I divide by the incoming state, I'm just going to put, so this is epsilon left, but I'm just going to put the same state without the subscript I, which means that there's no interface there. Okay, so this is what we discussed before. I want to estimate the incoming wave without the interface, and I'm going to take the limit for d that goes to infinity. Okay, and then the reflection coefficient from the right, from matter incoming from the left, is similar. This time I will want to measure reflected energy, but now I need to subtract. I need to subtract the energy that came in the energy that went out without the interface. This was the bump that was going towards the left without ever hitting the interface, and then I divide by the same thing. Okay, and again, I take the limit. So this now is a specific definition, which is it makes intuitive sense, and it passes some trivial tests. In particular, it passes the test that reflection from transmission is equal to 1, which is non-trivial. You just have to compute, and you'll see that in the limit, this is what you get. The states, all the, no, sorry, I'm just putting one subscript. Yeah, I just didn't want to put them, yeah.
Sorry, I'm a little confused about what you mean by the state without the interface. I thought we set up the interface from minus 9 infinity to plus 9.
Yeah, it's true.
If I quantize the theory on constant time slice, don't I always have the interface? Maybe I missed the part that
Yeah, so when you do, it's true, the way you set up the state, you integrate in Euclidean signature up to some time, and then you evolve in Lorentzian for a while. But you're not forced to push the interface, right? There is a well-defined CFT left, which just exists without the interface. So what I mean is that this correlation function is just literally the correlation function in translational invariant theory. I never put the defect in the first place. I don't need to do the same path integral here and here. These are just two different three-point functions, okay? The point is that I'm estimating this energy that I didn't want to get, for instance, this one that was going away in the absence of the interface. Good, so because there's no I here and there is I here, the normalization of this state goes to the one without the interface in the limit equal infinity. You can just compute it. So I should divide by the norm are equal in the limit. Okay, I'm not saying that this state exists in some Hilbert space. I'm really taking the limit afterwards, right? It's always a weak limit. So I compute a two-point function, I take the limit, the two-point function just goes to the translational invariant two-point function, so the norm is the same. Okay, so now the proof. Well, the proof relies on two assumptions, I think they're physically well motivated, but this I'm very up for suggestions and discussions, because we could not really prove them. So assumption number one is that the state is that all these correlation functions are analytic even in the limit. So they're analytic everywhere because there's an I epsilon. But I'm going to say that they're analytic also when d is strictly infinity, which is slightly trickier. Infinity is sort of a strange place. For instance, what I'm saying is that they're analytic. Okay. Sorry, I need to introduce more notation for this. Okay, let me just write what correlation function I'm going to talk about, and then we can discuss analyticity properties and the limit, and then I can go for something else. So the correlation function we discuss is correlation functions of 3 points. I'm going to focus on transmission because reflection is 1 minus transmission, so I don't care. So this is the correlation function. This guy has 2 cross ratios that I'm calling C and U, and some prefactor, which is completely uninteresting, which I'm choosing so that F is equal to 1 in the translational invariant theory. Now, here are the assumptions. The assumption is that when I take the limit D to infinity, where Z bar 1 and Z bar 2 go away, this is still a F of C U, is an analytic function of Z, or the position of the stress tensor. It's pretty reasonable because, you see, we're measuring the energy deposited at infinity pointwise, and we're taking the operator going to minus infinity. There's nothing happening for them. But it's worth mentioning because this limit is certainly not an analytic limit for Z1 and Z2 themselves. It's a branch point. It's sort of a Lyapunov limit. I can be more precise if you want. And okay, so this is the main assumption that I'm going to need. Then what I'll do is just to take the limit. So let's discuss briefly this. So the cross ratios I chose so that Xi only sees the two operators that create the state. And the limit is basically can just be replaced by the limit Xi going to 0. So this is the limit that we're taking. And U is another cross ratio that knows. This one I never remember, but knows about the third point. Well, let me just, I'm not yet running out of time, so I can write the cross ratio. This is slightly pedantic, but I want to draw a plot of where are the branch points of this cross ratio, so I would like to draw it, to write it. Z1, 2, Z plus C1, 1. Okay, so this cross ratio is the one that knows about the position of the stress tensor, which is at infinity measuring interface, measuring the energy that passes. And now I can just draw the contour. So I'm taking C to 0, so let's draw the U plane at fixed C. There are 2 special points, U equal 1 and U equal infinity somewhere else. At U, and the best way to understand these special points is to draw the picture. Again, I have my interface. I have the stress tensor being integrated here. And then I have the 2 local operators somewhere. One creates the bra, one creates the cat. There are 2 light cones that may meet if there was no I epsilon. They would meet the trajectory of the stress tensor in 2 points. So this is U equal 1, U equal infinity. The contour does never hit these points, because there is an I epsilon prescription. I'm creating a normalizable state. So if I draw the contour here, it's going to look like a circle. Okay, it starts somewhere. Actually, it doesn't matter. So it's a circle, and that it's a circle is pretty simple to see. This is an SL2 transformation of Z, so it's a circle. And now here I need to draw a cut, in general. because these singularities here are not Lyapunov singularities in the usual sense. The Lyapunov singularities are not OP singularities. In particular, the stress sensor does not need to commute with the other operators past the singularity. And in particular, if you compute in some example, you see that there are cuts. So the most general thing that can happen is that these are branch points, and these are branch points in general. Okay? This is at fixed C. Fixed C, which means fixed D in the situation before. And now we're going to use heavily the fact that this function is supposed to be analytic in U, even at C equals 0. And we first start, so you see, since I'm passing a cut, I will have some limit in the region of convergence of the OP. And if I draw the region of convergence of the OP, it goes something like this. Okay, it cuts the space in half, and say here, yes, here, no. Or at least, well, here, yes. I'm not sure it's optimal. I'm sure it comes from some raw coordinates. So part of the contour lies in the region where the OP converges, part doesn't. Let's see what happens in the region where the OP converges when I take the limit. So when I take the limit, I need to remember two things. So what's the fastest way of doing this? So here the OP converges, so let's look operator by operator being exchanged and see what is the behavior. So the operators which are exchanged in the OP are...
Mark, can I ask a question? So you started your talk by giving us all these intuitive arguments, you know, the stress test is factorized, some nice pictures going left and right. What is going on right now? Are you trying to show us that those intuitive arguments are correct? Why do you have to work so hard to show something so obvious? Can you explain what could have possibly gone wrong with those arguments? Why you have to now work so hard? Because it's hard to like be motivated to follow these technicalities.
Why was that thing
too naive? Because maybe it was just
good.
Correct, so we can go home.
First, the intuitive arguments were useful to get the definition of transmission and reflection. They're completely useless to understand, at least to me or to us when we work, to understand why it's universal. It does not mean when I take this limit, I'm just saying I know how to disentangle the contribution so that I get the total energy transmitted and reflected. There is no way I'm getting out of that that it does not depend on the operator I'm putting in. Okay?
Why not?
Why, yes.
Any state, you said any state was going left and right, so exactly it just shows that nothing depends on anything. You can take any state created by operator, by whatever.
No, I don't think this is correct.
By a potato, why not?
Because the point that everything is going left and right does not tell you how much of the energy goes left and how much of the energy goes right. That's just was a problem. The fact that nothing's get stuck on the interface is a property of the gluing condition. The reflection and transmission coefficient precisely measure how transparent the interface is, and that's not fixed by any symmetry and by any intuitive argument. So this is why I was going through the technicality. Also, you should be worried that there is a cross ratio. There are cross ratios in this function. You should really be worried how the hell am I getting a universal result? It's like a number, right? In principle, this could depend on the wave function I convolute the state with. It depends on momenta. If you were to shoot stuff against this wall, the neutrinos would go through, and the photons wouldn't, and the momentum would also matter. So this is why.
Okay.
Does this answer the question? Okay,
yeah,
so...
Yeah, now I'm more motivated.
Sorry? Very good. So this explains, so that the independence of the wave function is actually simple to get, because one way to get this is that the reflection coefficient can only depend on some ratio. And the only ratio you have at your disposal is the left moving divided by the right moving momentum. This is Lorentz invariant. But the problem, and this is scale invariant, the problem is that one of the two should not enter this expression because one of the two is just a matter that goes away. So then you get that this has to be a constant. So yeah, the independence from the wave function is not surprising. The independence from the state, I think, was more surprising. Okay, so, but okay, let me be quick since everybody seems already to believe this, so I won't need to worry about the fact that there are assumptions in this proof. The proof goes as follows. So there is a region of convergence of the OP, and the way in which it works is that in this region, the xi going to zero limit is a Lyapunov limit. There are various ways to see this, and now I'm not going to go into the details anymore. But one way is to say that it's to map to rock coordinates and see what that limit looks there. Since it's a Lipkin limit, at xi, so as xi goes to zero in the O left times O left OPE, there are only lowest H bar operator, right? Lowest twist. And that have been exchanged. And this would still be a problem because there are infinitely many of those in a 2D CFT. But now there's another thing that comes to help, that is that only spin 2 operators, these are exchanged operators. Only spin 2 operators have a non-zero, so let's call them TI, have a non-zero two-point function with a stress tensor on the right. So these are TI left. Okay, so this is, it's because they're quasi-prime. Well, okay, there are various ways to see this. One way is to map this configuration on a sphere. There's some equator, there's a rotational symmetry, so the spin must match. Okay, it works for quasi-primaries, obviously. Okay, so then we get that only the only H exchange that survives is this, okay? So 2,0 operators. And in particular, the natural assumption is that there is only one, which is a stress tensor of the left theory. Okay, so where the region of the, where the OP converges on the left, we get, yeah. Yeah, if there is an extended symmetry, this is what was hinting at before, then you get a sum. So this is some sort of the more general result. And this is actually an interesting part. This is why I was mentioning it before, because it's this reflection and transmission coefficient is a bit more detailed than what Queller-Runkelmann was defined. You should expect that this idea of universality when you go against the wall will not work if there are conserved charges, because the wall might preserve some of them. So it will be able to tell apart operators which are different representations under these charges, and indeed it does. So it does through the existence of other 2,0 operators. But OK, now I want to maybe just go with a simpler setup. And so if there is only one, then basically we get the result. So the idea is that we discussed the OP, we discussed the limit xi going to 0 of this function. The limit xi going to 0 of this function becomes just the exchange of one block. This block is extremely simple to compute. It's also the only SL2 block that survives when the interface is not there. That's the only operator which is being exchanged. So it's just F0 U equal to a constant, which is essentially C left right. Okay? So the way in which this works is because in the region of convergence of the OPE, it just works through the Lipkin limit. And then I'm going to appeal to analyticity of this function here to say that it's a constant along part of the path, and it's analytic along all of the path. So it's a constant everywhere. OK? Bottom line, the full problem is reduced to the exchange of a single block, which means a single piece of CFT data. And this piece of CFT data, since there was only the stress sensor on the left that I'm picking up in this OPE, becomes proportional to T left. The right, which is what I previously called the C left right. Okay, there is obviously a normalization factor from the definition before, and then you get this result, that this is the ratio. Okay, so this concludes the proof, and I would like now to go to some consequences, a few consequences, and then the example, and then conclude. Depending if there are other questions. No? I'll just erase. Okay, so consequences. I think I already talked enough about the universality of this result. And I would like just to comment then on some on the bound that we get and the relation to the displacement operator, since it was asked.
Sorry, just to make sure.
Yes.
I'm trying to comprehend where the
Yeah, so on the cylinder, or on the Poincaré patch, well, yeah. Yeah, so the stress tensor can be anywhere because it only depends on holomorphically, but I can put it here, say, and then I'm integrating. Ah, sorry. Yeah, that's a good point. There is another thing that I passed under the carpet. No, I don't say. The other two points are somewhere here and are getting to minus infinity at keeping constant in this direction. So let's say like this. Well, they're going to infinity together in the Poincaré patch, of course. So. Yeah, so this was all left, and the stress sensor was up there. Okay? So this is why this limit is slightly unusual. This is a Lyapunov limit on the cylinder, so this is why the analyticity assumption is a bit, it's still an assumption. Okay, so. Yeah, the ordinary operator matters when I'm past that point. Right? So there was a whole point where the OP had to converge, because, so the operators are ordered in this way. The ordering doesn't matter when I'm here, because they're space like separated. One can be more precise with rho coordinates, say that where the regional convergence of the OP precisely, because there's I epsilon separation. But if you forget about I epsilon, then you can just talk about space like separation. Here the ordering doesn't matter, and then I can use the OP. And here I need to appeal to analyticity of the function to say that it was a constant, it remains a constant. Okay? Okay, so this is normally what you do in radial quantization in Euclidean signature, and indeed this works because the ket and the bra are being computed according to the time on the cylinder, so they're time ordered on the cylinder. Here I'm saying this is a Lorentzian slice, and the Euclidean time goes sideways, goes out of the blackboard. So the plus I epsilon minus I epsilon is the ordering in Euclidean time, which is what matters for the ordering of this correlation function. The way you should think about that in quantization is that you have some operator created at some Euclidean time, and then you're measuring. So this z is some x and t. So the idea is that these are Heisenberg states, which are created as usual. You could think of that on the cylinder. This is at earlier Euclidean time than this guy, earlier Euclidean time than this guy. And then this one gets conjugated by some other operator, which is now the Lorentzian Hamiltonian. Say t0 e to the minus iht. So I'm just probing my Heisenberg state with a Lorentzian evolution operator, like the usual Heisenberg picture. Okay, so the idea is that we evolved in the path inter in Euclidean up to some point, we cut, then we place an operator that we evolved sideways in Lorentzian time by using the usual Lorentzian Hamiltonian, and then we evolve from plus infinity in Euclidean again, and we close the path integral.
And the safe region is?
The safe region is? Exactly, it's this one, because safe in the region is safe everywhere as long as d is not infinity. I think also when d is infinity, but anyway. The safe region is just what I, it's the region where I can use the OPE, right? In order to use the OPE between these two.
When the light passes the P, right, is not in the middle.
Yes, exactly. So this has to be here. Exactly, yes. Okay. Okay, so let me just make some quick comments about bounds. So this discussion implies some bounds because I would like energy to be positive when it goes at infinity. And this means that, in particular, since there is only one coefficient it depends on, there are stricter bounds than what you might expect. So the fact that it both reflection from the left and from the right need to be less than one means that they cannot both be one if the two CFTs are different. So this bound just comes from, it's just a union of the two bounds, the intersection of the two bounds on left and right transmission. And it means in particular that you can never transmit completely energy from a CFT with more degrees of freedom to a CFT with less degrees of freedom. The transmission coefficient is strictly bounded, which is kind of satisfactory, so we're happy. And also, it fixes bounds on the displacement operator. So these are stronger than Euclidean bounds, by the way. So you can get Euclidean bounds, and these are going to be strictly weaker, as it's now kind of usually the case when we consider n-ec operators. So the displacement operator is just some difference of the stress tensors evaluated at the interface. And it's the operator, so just to give one possible definition, if I vary the location of the interface by a little bit, some dx, then this is just the double integral of the displacement two-point function, dt prime times dx. Okay, so it measures the variation of the cost of the free energy cost of the deformation of the interface. So it's a very Euclidean thing. But it turns out, and okay, its two-point function is normally called CD, so it's proportional to a number which is called CD. And it turns out that CD is basically just a combination of reflection coefficients from the left and from the right. So this is a nice connection between statistical mechanics and dynamics. And it also turns out that the bounds that we set dynamically for reflection turn into bounds which are stronger than the Euclidean bounds for CD. In particular, CD has to be greater or equal than the difference of the central charge divided by, right? The bigger bound is just something like the sum of the central charges. I remember the normalization now. Let me just look it up. Upper bound is not changed, so it's a bit less interesting, but just to be complete. Yeah, twice. Because I'm writing the normalization for something else. There is no denominator here, there is a 2, and there is C left plus C right. Okay, I'm writing this because this is stronger than the Euclidean bounds, and this is pretty much related to what was done here, meaning that the transmission coefficient of Queller, Unkel, and Watts, as I was saying, is some average of left and right reflection. And they conjecture bound for this quantity they could improve, which were exactly these bounds. So pretty good. Precisely. Yeah, this establishes precisely the connection between deformation of the free energy, it's costing free energy in deforming the interface and the amount of energy that passes through. Okay, so I think it's about time to conclude. So let me just mention as a sketch, as I still have 5 minutes, I think. So are there comments or questions on this? If not, then I'll erase, and I'll just... in this derivation, I also assume C left equals C bar left, so the theory not being chiral, but you can just extend everything very easily to chiral cases. Well, not parity preserving cases. So I would just like to mention one application. Because I find it nice. So there is a nice set of work on non-equilibrium steady states. In CFTs. That provides some opportunity. Oh, okay, this is pretty speculative, but some opportunity to even measure these coefficients in one-dimensional quantum systems without having to resort to some Euclidean correlation function. And the reason is the following. So a steady state is defined by some reservoir put at the end of a long wire with two different temperatures. So it's a steady state, there is energy flux. The way to think about this is just that right movers come out at some temperature, left movers come out at some other temperature. The temperature without any defect, just in a CFT, is just fixed by the usual argument to be pi c over 12 beta left square. And similarly for the right stress sensor, these are the usual formulas. Now, this turns into an energy flux, which is proportional to the central charge. And to the square of the temperature, the difference of the temperature. Now, it's easy now to see what happens when you draw the same picture, but you put an impurity in the middle, and you flow to the infrared. And the reason is that we discussed if the larger symmetry is Virasoro, so we discussed every state has the same transmission and reflection coefficient, so we don't really care about the decoherent nature of thermal radiation, it's just it's creating some states, and all of the states will be transmitted and reflected in the same way. So in particular, we'll have some T left, some T bar right, some T bar left, and some T right. And these are all fixed. Because for instance, let me just write one, the expectation value of T right is just going to be the transmission coefficient for matter incoming from the left times the expectation value of T left plus the reflection coefficient from the right, and then the energy flux from the right. So you just plug these relations in, and then you get the energy flux in this steady state is equal on the two sides, this is a steady state, thermal evolution. And it's again, it has the same form, but now the central charge has been replaced by our reflection and transmission coefficient. So it's the same form, same functional form. Different coefficient. And okay, first of all, this is a relation that would be hard to get if you didn't know that reflection and transmission are universal. And second, it depends on the temperatures in a very peculiar way, so who knows, maybe there are some quantum impurity system in which you can actually be so as precise to measure this quantity in this way. This, though, it's very far out of my expertise, so I think we're gonna talk to some condensed matter people, but I'm not sure. So I think I'm out of time, so let me just draw my conclusions. I think, okay, comments about the result, we've made enough, so let me just conclude talking about future directions. One obvious future direction, so there are a few obvious works that one should do. One is to see what happens with reflection and transmission event by event. Not just in average, but what happens when you do the experiment. So in other words, measure higher moments of the distribution of the stress tensor and see if they're also universal. One might expect at some point that they're not universal anymore, which would be interesting. Another obvious direction is a higher dimensional case. And I think that's pretty much under control. The reason being is that we should, again, not be too ambitious on what we want to measure. If we have a higher dimensional interface, we want to measure, again, the total energy that passes through. And although the stress tensor is not topological, the total energy is, again, a topological operator. So I can, again, move it around and make the correlation function into compute pretty much easier. The result should, again, be universal, I think. But we can discuss maybe. I'm happy to discuss this with if there are interesting people. Other possible directions are non-conformal lines in conformal field theories. You could measure reflection and transmissions for those. And explore, I didn't talk much about it, but explore this more general case in which there are symmetries. So there are reflection and transmission depend on the operator you shoot at the interface. This is some exercise in conformal field theories that it's interesting to do because it gives us more access to more qualitative features of defects. And then, let me not mention one of the things I wanted to mention, but let me mention instead that this all bounds, the bounds on the reflection and transmission were coming from positivity of the charges. And this is an anek kind of problem. In 2D it's easier because it's really the total charge, but still, there's a defect in the middle, so it's not exactly the total charge of the state. So strictly speaking, that's not proven, and it would take some more work to actually prove that the anek operator is positive in these states, which are not translational invariant states, which is very reasonable and certainly true, but just to be precise, it's not rigorously proven yet. And with this, I think I'll conclude. Thank you very much for your attention.
Do you think there is anything to be gained from considering 1 over d corrections that would be non-universal and then trying to use your positivity, right?
1 over d corrections, so not sending the states far away enough.
So just light form limit, but not all the way, I guess.
I mean, yeah, so I think the interest in that would be in understanding better the technical part of what we did. So I said that when we send the operator to infinity, we have perfect control of the incoming energy and how the state is built. And also I appeal to some analyticity of the current. Actually, this is a very good point to mention. One thing that I forgot to mention. One thing that I assumed is that I can swap the integration over the stress tensor that measures the total energy with the limit d going to infinity, right? I measured the limit of the correlation function. This is, again, physically very reasonable, and you can also point out cases where this doesn't happen in other observables. The reason why it's reasonable is that the energy stays fixed. The bump in energy at infinity doesn't move when I take that limit, right? It's just there. There's nothing that runs away to infinity, so I'm not losing anything in the limit. Except, of course, this is a detailed question about the OPE and how the subleading terms in Xi, the other cross ratios, are behaving when I integrate over U. So although we did check that this is true, well, we have a very solid physical argument, we did check that this is true in non-trivial examples, taking the D finite and redoing the whole thing, it's a technical work, but it will kind of strengthen that point, which is the second assumption of the proof.
Are the corrections going like d to the h bar of the next one?
They will go like some power, but the point is that the coefficient of the power depends on u, and you need to check that the integral is nice, is finite.
So how much should one worry about infrared divergences in these calculations? So we speak about the vacuum on the line and things like that.
So these are conformal primary operators, so I think they're all infrared safe. Even in higher D, they will be infrared safe. And also, I'm not trying to measure a scattering amplitude, I measure an inclusive quantity. Mm-hmm. So the lore, okay. I am not sure I have an answer to a complete level of rigor, but the lore is that inclusive quantities are finite because I'm just summing up the whole thing. So if I were trying to measure the overlap between an incoming state and the outgoing state, so the amplitude rather than the transmission and reflection coefficients, I would have to worry. And the question, I would certainly have to worry if my states are not gauge invariant local operators. There's some argument in people that know about infrared divergences better than me that I should still not worry if I'm measuring states created by local operators of the theory because their correlation functions will just be finite. But in this case, I think there is really no question because it's an inclusive quantity. It's like the probability to go into a jet, not the probability to go into a particle. Mm-hmm.